This is the Florida Roundup, Elevation Zero, Rising Seas in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. There's a quotation often attributed to Danish physicist Niels Bohr, though historians doubt that it originated with him. It goes, "Prediction is very difficult, especially about the future." That's the nature of forecasting, isn't it? By definition, it is about what may happen. And that's tough if it's the 10-day weather forecast or if it's a prediction over rising seas.
What will sea level rise be in 2100? Simple answer. Somewhere between
1.6 to 4.9 feet.
Perfectly clear, right? Well, this much we do know. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has used tidal gauges and then satellite altimetry to determine the sea level in South Florida has risen about 9 inches since the 1920s. What do you make of those predictions? Do you believe them? What do you see as evidence of higher seas? Do your plans for your home or work take into account higher sea level in the generations ahead? Join us at 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. Email us at thefloridaroundup@wlrn.org. Follow the tweets at WLRN or the live chat right now at WLRN.org. Curtis Morgan with the Miami Herald is along with us. Alex Chadwick, the producer and reporter of Rising Seas, Burn, and Energy Journal radio documentary. Alex is also a former NPR reporter and editor. Craig Pittman joins us from the Tampa Bay Times. And Ben Kurtman is a professor of meteorology and physical oceanography at the University of Miami. Professor, we'll begin with you. Is the 9-inch sea level rise since the 1920s a scientific fact?
Yeah, that's good data. The data we've had around Key West goes pretty far back and is pretty robust data. I'm more inclined to believe from 1950 to the present, a little bit more than all the way back to 1920. But I think that's a good number on the order of 9 inches since 1920 is a solid number. That's a fact.
That's a solid number. Now, the why behind it, Professor.
Well, why behind it is the climate system has been warming. And what that means is there's been thermal expansion of the world's oceans. So as you warm the ocean, it expands and sea level rises. There's been some signal, although fairly small, due to the melting of ice on land. But it's tricky. There's a tricky element here, and that the fact that ocean circulation matters, you know, how the currents work near the coastal zone and so forth will affect sea level rise. But I do believe that that 9-inch number is scientific fact.
Curtis Morgan, you've been reporting on the environment for a long time here in South Florida and in the Caribbean, a 9-inch scientific fact looking back. But it is tricky when we say, what do we know from here on out?
Oh yeah, I mean it's. I think the professor would probably agree that this is a relatively new science, and we've had articles in our paper and produced by WLRN recently that has shown a fairly wide range in the predictions. I mean, the official one here for Miami-Dade or for South Florida is 9 to 24 inches by 2060. That's been adopted by the four counties down here. But when you talk to individual experts, you get ranges that, you know, 3 feet, 6 feet, or less. So there's a fairly wide array of predictions about timing and amounts.
Alex Chadwick, you spoke with experts across the globe about some of these predictions, and certainly you concentrated some of your reporting on South Florida. But the trickiness of these predictions is substantial and significant.
Well, it is. But you can look at organizations like the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. These are not alarmists. These are data-driven people. And it's I believe it's their projection for 2060, this 9 to 24 inches. And the Corps of Engineers by 2030, the sea level rise in South Florida, 3 to 7 inches. So it's substantial from what look to me to be very authoritative positions, and it's something we have to face and think about.
And we'll certainly talk about that. Craig Pittman from the Tampa Bay Times from the Bay Area. We're talking about obviously South Florida, and we'll talk about some of the differences between South, Central, and North Florida, and just how folks are approaching these kinds of variables and expectations. But the variety of predictions down here, is it resonating in the Bay Area?
Well, certainly. And there's a further factor you have to bear in mind, too, and that is I think what people care about is not really how high it might rise, but how far inland it might encroach. Florida being such a flat state, obviously even a few inches, it's going to come pretty far inland. But the other variable here, too, is that along the Florida coastline, we have an awful lot of it that has already had seawalls built. Mm-hmm. And so a few inches is not going to make a big difference if you have a seawall there. Anytime someone puts out one of those maps that says, oh, my God, look how much of the Florida is going to be underwater. Well, you know, there are a lot of variables there, and it makes it all seem kind of shaky.
Ben Kirtman, the professor of meteorology and physical oceanography at the University of Miami. The variations are driven by predictive science. To Curtis Morgan's point about a relatively young scientific field of inquiry, does that challenge the ability to make these predictions?
Oh, absolutely. There is a lot of uncertainty in these predictions, and in fact, the fact that we can only say it's 3 to 7 inches by 2030, we can't actually put probabilities on 3 versus 7. That's reflecting the fact that it is new science, and we do have a long way to go. Ultimately, we'd like to say, you know, what's the chance of 3 inches? What's the chance of 4 inches and 7 inches, so on and so forth, so that someone could make decisions. I would like to underscore another point, and that is that sea level rise in Florida is tricky. Yes, seawalls can help, but it's important to remember that we have a really porous surface, and so some of that seawater is coming in underneath the ground, and that's pushing up the fresh water, and so that's contaminating our freshwater aquifers, and so you're going to get inland inundation with sea level rise, mm-hmm. even if you have a seawall. So it is important, you know, I agree it's important not to be alarmist, but it is important to make decisions on the science that's available here. You know, I'm not a policy person, but there are many other aspects to sea level rise, not just, you know, this stuff that's coming in over the coast, but this inundation that's coming in under land. Yeah. I think that's an important part.
Yeah, one of the sciences that you have to consider here, Curtis, is geology of what we built upon here, certainly in South Florida. And, you know, you talk about evidence that anecdotally folks will point to, high tides, king tides, those kinds of things. And that is when we talk about it happening, for instance, on Miami Beach, it's not on the ocean side that's getting flooded. The geology is such where the beach in Miami Beach is actually among the highest places of the barrier island.
That's
right?
True. Yes, that's true. And the professor is making a good point. And that those are some of the effects that we're already seeing. As that ocean level rises, we're seeing our freshwater aquifer shrink from the pressure outside. Now, some of that may also have to do with the fact that we've dammed off the Everglades, and we don't no longer have as much fresh water flowing south to bolster that aquifer. But that's one of the effects. As the groundwater rises, also our flood capacity will shrink because the rain won't have anywhere to go. So, I mean, this isn't going to be the problem. Isn't just going to be suddenly you step out your front yard into a puddle of seawater. It's going to be these incremental changes mm-hmm. that are going to happen over a long period of time and already are happening.
Alex Chadwick with Rising Seas, a Burn special and former NPR reporter. You spoke with folks again across the globe. And when we hear about anecdotal stories about evidence of rising seas, and that's what it amounts to. It's anecdotal in terms of what neighbors and residents are seeing. We got this comment from our Public Insight Network from Maryland and Fort Lauderdale. Can we really attribute the unusually high tides accompanying the seasonal full moons with rising seas? Could it just be the unusual pull of lunar forces on the Earth's water? When you look at just the natural phenomenon that has happened, what did you find out as you went through your reporting for Rising Seas?
Well, of course, there have always been king tides, and the lunar force and solar force on the tides. But when the water expands in the ocean, there's a consequence for that. These very high tides are even higher. I mean, they've been a common element of people's lives in Florida for a long time, but the degree to which they appear at least anecdotally, from many people, is they're getting worse.
Yeah, and one go ahead. The frequency we've seen, for instance, the reporting that we've done this week with folks on Big Pine Key, the frequency that some of those multi-generational residents have seen has increased. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah. So one of the things that, you know, when you say 3 to 7 inches and the probability of this or that, one of the things that really strikes me, I've spent about 3 years now looking at energy questions, and to me, climate is and climate and energy are tied together intimately. Like you can't really separate them. So when scientists make these projections, and they've been making them about climate for 25, 30 years now. In almost everything I cover in politics and all kinds of things, the kind of the norm, the center, turns out to be approximately correct almost, you know, most of the time, right? But with climate, it's the extremes that turn out to be correct. That is, these predictions, Kate, you know, will say, okay, it might be a foot by the end of by 2100. Well, now it's 4 feet by 2100. So you just worry that if it's 3 to 7 inches, maybe it'll be 6 inches. And 6 inches is real trouble, real trouble.
It is real trouble for lots of areas. Craig Pittman from Tampa Bay Times. What do these forecasts mean for your stakeholders?
readers, maybe?
Well, they're readers, but they're also stakeholders, yes, in the community in Tampa Bay, yes, and certainly members of this greater thing that we've decided to call Florida.
Right. Well, I mean, we're certainly already seeing some of the effects of sea level rise here, documented with at Wakasasa State Park up in Levy County. Palm trees are toppling over dead because the rising salt water is coming up the beach and they can't live there anymore. In Rookery Bay Preserve near Naples, saltwater mangroves have invaded what used to be freshwater marshes. I mean, these are the kind of subtle changes where if you're going out there, you know, as a tourist or something to visit those places, you're not going to necessarily notice that. But these are the areas where the coast is not armored and sea level rise is happening, and you can see the changes that are occurring there.
Craig Pittman, join us from the Tampa Bay Times. Craig, your readers may be interested in the answer to this question that we need to pose to the professor, Ben Kirtman, of the University of Miami. Professor, this came to us via our Twitter handle, at WLRN, from Barbara, wondering if sea level rise can make sinkholes more common.
I think these things are loosely connected in the sense that how our whole freshwater system, saltwater system interacts throughout the state, but the direct connection between increasing rates of sinkholes and sea level, I don't believe there's any robust science been done there yet. So I don't think there's a clear connection.
The suspicion there is more that you're drawing down the aquifers and pulling water out of those areas.
Creating cavities.
Which I think that's really just our agricultural demand.
That is Ben Kirtman, professor of meteorology and physical oceanography at the University of Miami. We've got Alex Chadwick, producer-reporter for Rising Seas, a Burn special documentary on the radio, Curtis Morgan from the Miami Herald, and Craig Pittman from the Tampa Bay Times. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup, Elevation Zero, Rising Seas in South Florida. Still to come, the threats from insurance rates to our drinking water when the Florida Roundup continues. This is the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. Elevation Zero, Rising Seas in South Florida.
The first 3 to 6 inches of sea level rise won't necessarily make streets unpassable, but it's going to get into the fresh water table, the saltwater intrusion, which you've heard about. The first impact of sea level rise is that we're going to have a real problem with our fresh water supply.
That's John Englander, author of High Tide on Main Street and a South Florida resident. When WLRN's Christine DiMattei asked him to take her to see evidence of higher seas, he took her to a storm drain in Fort Lauderdale. Not a beach, not a canal, a storm drain that was almost filled, even though it hadn't rained in days. We are talking about the threat of rising seas in South Florida, the reality, the questions, The Theory. Welcome here to the Florida Roundup. Join us with your questions at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can tweet us at the call sign at WLRN and join the live discussion right now online hosted by Rachel Morello at WLRN.org. Curtis Morgan with the Miami Herald. Alex Chadwick, a reporter, producer for Rising Seas, a Burn special documentary on the radio, and Craig Pittman from the Tampa Bay Times, all with us. Now joined by Jim Murley, Executive Director of the South Florida Regional Planning Council, an agency that helps local governments address planning issues. He will join us in a moment. From Tampa Bay, Craig, you were mentioning some of the evidence that you're seeing around the Bay Area, and some of that evidence is being articulated in vegetation, which is, I believe, evidence of that saltwater intrusion and getting over to the freshwater drinking supplies. So the question is how much interest, how much focus, how much concentration does that seem to be garnering?
Not much at this point. Most of the attention has been along people who live along the rivers in this area, who are noticing that where they had freshwater fish, now they're starting to see more saltwater fish, or they're starting to find barnacles on their boats where they did not have them before. Those are the kind of things that they're noticing, but I don't think anyone has put together in their minds, hey, wait a minute, this is going to affect our drinking water supply, or anything else at this point. One thing I forgot to mention earlier, there was a 2007 study by an FSU geology professor that found that Florida's beaches are already losing on average more than 4 feet a year because of sea level rise.
And that's through erosion, is that fair to say, Craig?
Well, no, he was, well, yeah, but obviously rising sea, you have more beach erosion.
Yeah. Craig, to the point of the intrusion into the drinking water table, we have seen more and more interest on the part of some communities about desalination efforts, about trying to put together the technology to ensure a freshwater drinking supply.
Yes, and we do have the largest, North America's largest desalination plant here in the Tampa Bay area, but it was not built because of sea level rise. It was built because of concerns about drought and about overpumping that was draining wetlands and lakes and so forth in the area. We also have an increased interest in surface water skimming in order to provide for drinking water supply. So the idea is to get more water from places other than pumping it out of the ground, but that was not driven by a concern about sea level rise. I guess that's sort of an added benefit.
Well, the saltwater intrusion in South Florida has already forced some communities, I think particularly in South Broward, like Hallandale, mm-hmm. to abandon some coastal wells and drill new wells inland. And that's expected to be a trend that continues along the coast. And you can, people always argue, well, I haven't seen this rise. It's been flooding like this for decades. But you can look and you can map that saltwater intrusion line along the entire coast marching inland every year.
And among those agencies that are interested in those kinds of charts, South Florida Regional Planning Council, Jim Murley is executive director of the council. He does now join us here on the Florida Roundup, Elevation Zero, Rising Seas in South Florida. Jim, let's focus on saltwater intrusion, the threat to freshwater drinking supplies. Tell us on the policy side, what kind of attention is this getting?
Well, it's always been a focus in South Florida as we worry about how saltwater could impact the Biscayne Aquifer, where we pull our drinking water. And it's been the focus of our public utilities. I know right now that Broward County and Miami-Dade County are working in collaboration with the United States Geological Survey to do some pretty detailed modeling with the best available data to sort of, do their predictions about how the rising sea level might affect drinking water.
That's Jim Murley with the South Florida Regional Planning Council. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. You're invited to join the conversation at 800-743-9576. George joins the program from Fort Lauderdale. George, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for having me on. I was recently in Greece, and my father's on a village which is right on the water, and I live on the water here in Fort Lauderdale. I've asked everyone I know, is the sea level rising? Have you seen it rise? Or, have you seen a difference? And nobody can ever say yes or point to any evidence. And the fact that there's saltwater intrusion, isn't that just because we're pulling more fresh water out of the aquifers?
Well, George, I live in Fort Lauderdale, and I can tell you those tides are higher than I remember. This is Curtis Morgan, that I remember. And I think you're right in terms of saltwater intrusion and teasing out the effect of us pulling more water out of the aquifer, us shutting off the flow of the Everglades, you know, how much of that has contributed to the issues we have along the coast. But there are dozens of other measures of saltwater intrusion. You can look down at Everglades National Park, where the mangroves are marching inland. They've marched inland several miles. The chief scientist of Everglades pointed it out to me. That's not an issue of us drawing water out of wells. And Craig just cited similar issues along the west coast of Florida. So if you look at the ecological signals, you'll see that it's happening there.
Alex Chadwick with us, who was the producer and reporter of Rising Seas, a Byrne special radio documentary heard earlier this week here on WLRN. I respond to George's concern that he doesn't see, his neighbors don't see this slow creep of rising seas in their experience, but yet we have the science that shows, certainly over the last two generations, that seas have risen.
Right. Well, you know, I guess if my grandfather were still alive, and he died probably 20 years ago, you know, he was alive in 1920. So if you had started in 1920 and to today, and the sea rises 9 inches over that time, yes, it's not going to be something that you notice and you say, oh, wait a minute, it covered that rock, you know, what, 3 inches lower back in 1962 or something. It's hard to notice these gradual incremental changes, but that doesn't mean they're not occurring.
I will liken it to my hairline, if I may.
Yes. Well, exactly.
As I'm looking at Mr. Morgan here, who has a growing forehead like I do.
What George is saying is, but we have tide gauges that definitively show that it has happened. And the question now is that trend going to accelerate?
But will it continue, and at what speed?
And at what speed?
That's
so
right.
So the neighbor's not seeing it doesn't mean it's not happening. The gauges show it has happened.
When we are talking about some of the big impacts here, we mentioned saltwater intrusion. Insurance is also a key factor when talking about the economy and the possible impact that we may see in our pocketbooks from the threat of rising seas. Jim Murley, Executive Director of the South Florida Regional Planning Council. What role does insurance play in kind of the understanding and the communication of the threat of rising seas?
Well, of course, insurance is fundamental to all development activity, both public and private, along South Florida, both from the standpoint of flooding and wind insurance for hurricanes. And the insurance industry is built upon taking the data, understanding frequency and the intensities, and then making models which they use in pricing insurance. And as we understand it, they're beginning to do the same thing to better understand how sea level rise might add to the risk. And this really comes in messages from the reinsurance industry, mm-hmm. the large industry that is buys the policies that we have as individuals, much in the way as Fannie Mae buys mortgages from banks. And they're Swiss Re and the Geneva Group, they're all signaling that they're starting to look at the data in order to price in that risk. And if they do that, it'll work its way down to the individual policies that we are looking at when we try to insure our own homes.
Craig Pittman covers the environment at the Tampa Bay Times. You know, Craig, what's interesting about this insurance intersection with the rising seas and the threat is that on the front line of that, if I may mix a metaphor, but on the front line of that really is the National Flood Insurance Program that folks who live in designated flood zones wind up having to buy because of the mortgage rules if they're having a note on their home. And that's where the coverage of rising seas come. It's not in the private insurance market, at least not yet for homeowners.
Right. And of course, in effect, we've been subsidizing the development of these low-lying coastal areas for years and years and years as taxpayers. And now that there's been a movement to try and shift some of that burden over to the people who are actually living there, there's enough people freaking out about the increase in the rates that Congress is trying to put the brakes on that happening.
That is Craig Pittman from the Tampa Bay Times, Curtis Morgan from the Miami Herald along with us as well, Alex Chadwick with Rising Seas, a Burn radio documentary, and Jim Murley, Executive Director of the South Florida Regional Planning Council. My name is Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN, a special version, Rising Seas in South Florida, Elevation Zero. Join the conversation at 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. You can join us on Twitter at WLRN or the live web chat going on now online, World Wide Web at WLRN.org. Sam joins us on the telephone from Miami. Sam, welcome to the program.
Hello, this is Sam Van Leer. I'm the president and founder of Urban Paradise Guild, and we're a Miami-based nonprofit. And we take a somewhat different approach to dealing with sea level rise. One of the things that we see is that the conversation locally, and it's great to have this conversation, it's great that it's taking place, but it tends to be dominated by extremes, either people who are still in denial that there is a problem, or people who have the sort of the sky is falling approach where, you know, of course, we're all very alarmed. What's often missing is the ability for people to actually directly influence our own safety, our own future. And so what we do is we offer volunteer opportunities six times every week that let people come out and actually make a difference in person. And it allows people to be creative. All our projects make Miami a better place to live today.
Sam, can you give us one example of the projects that that you're going to that you have residents get their hands wet, I guess?
Well, what we do is a mixture of urban forestry, urban agriculture, and nursery. So urban forestry includes planting trees on land that will absorb carbon, planting mangroves along the coastlines that absorb carbon and protect our coastline and coastal infrastructure. Urban agriculture, by providing families with alternatives to chemical farming, it prevents carbon release through chemical farming. And, of course, organic farming is healthier. And then nurseries provide plants and trees for all our projects.
Sam gets to the broader question of the larger cause of rising seas, just beyond, of course, the thermodynamics of seas, which we'll talk about later on in the program. We will get to this point here. He joins us from Miami. But Jim, with the South Florida Regional Planning Council, I'd like you just to address this idea of extremes that seem to drive the conversation. What's your experience as you're inside the boardrooms and the policymaking rooms throughout the region?
Well, I think we're fortunate in South Florida that you know, we're aware that we're vulnerable. We obviously have experienced within our own lifetimes the effect of storm events, and now we're learning more about sea level rise. And our local governments have come together, as you've reported during your special, and formed the Southeast Florida Climate Change Compact. And in as part of that, they pulled the best scientists from our local universities and our federal and state agencies, and they've got a consensus prediction, which you referred to earlier in the program. And that takes into consideration, you know, variables that are unique to Southeast Florida, our geology and our position vis-a-vis the ocean. So I think the compact is a direct response to the understanding by local elected officials in Southeast Florida that the vulnerability is there, and we need to not rely on either state or federal government to come in and help us, but to start right here with the best knowledge we have and start the process of planning and developing activities to build in resilience in our region.
Yeah, the word Jim is talking about there is resilience and adapting. Can we adapt and how do we adapt? And I think, Jim, I think one of the goals of the compact was to get federal attention and federal help, and particularly money, to come up with some sort of adaptation. So, I mean, do we raise our roads? Do we have to build new flood control gates? I mean, the South Florida Water Management District's coastal flood gates are based on gravity. When the sea rises, they don't work so well. They're already compromised at some degree, so they're going to have to spend tens of millions, I think $50, $60 million to retrofit these things with giant pumps.
Water does not run uphill.
No, Curtis. It does not run uphill.
So those pumps, though, are paid for with ad valorem dollars from Southeast Florida.
Yes, they are. But I remember, Jim, if I'm not mistaken, that there was some hope that by getting together politically that you could go to Washington and say, hey,
absolutely.
Look.
Absolutely. Right. It was a recognition that there is more persuasive power, a larger delegation of elected officials, both in Tallahassee and in Washington, that if we gave them a message from the region, they could be more effective in bringing resources back to help us. Absolutely.
Let me put this question to two folks who are not in South Florida, Alex Chadwick and Craig Pittman. Craig, I'll begin with you since you're at least in Florida. This Southeast Florida Regional Climate Compact is between the four counties here from Palm Beach, Broward, Miami-Dade, and Monroe counties. Any discussion, any kind of conversation that you are hearing in Central Florida that that would be similar?
No. No, absolutely not. And there's a real clear reason for that, and that is the state law doesn't require anyone to do that. And so absent some state law that says, hey, in your planning process, you need to start planning for sea level rise, local governments, especially the ones that are dealing with these deep budget cuts and so forth they've had to deal with the economic turndown, they're going to do the bare minimum. They're not going to look more than, say, 10 years ahead, and they're not going to look into that farther future and say, hey, sea level rise is already happening. What can we do to deal with it? Do we need to be not building in certain areas? Yeah. Do we need to be building our bridges higher? Things like that. So, no, they're not having those conversations.
Alex Chadwick, you looked at this threat from a national perspective, even going overseas. You know, what was the kind of general tone that you saw, especially on the engagement side, when you consider the four-county agreement here in South Florida that is pretty unique?
Well, let me just read a little bit to you from an email that was forwarded to me today. This morning from a friend in New York. This is from a real estate agent who is offering places at the Surf Club Four Seasons, which groundbreaking will begin on development of this maybe in January or February. They're offering these condos for, I mean, millions and millions and millions of dollars. The cheapest place there, $2.5 million. There's no requirement, and there could be at the county level, to say to a buyer of a property there, hey, you ought to just know that, you know, if you've got a 30-year mortgage, if you're planning on staying here 30 years, it's going to be a lot different in 30 years, that you're buying into a region that's in transition, and in a transition that's not going to be good for a lot of people who own property. But there's no requirement at all to caution buyers. Of course, you know, buyer beware. Yes,
you'll be fine on the third floor.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, but you know, suppose you low prediction comes in.
Suppose you want to go out for groceries, for God's sake.
The four county compact is indeed kind of cutting edge. But the truth of the matter is, it hasn't. All these counties are struggling with exactly what to do. What's the cost-benefit analysis? What should we build for? How much should we invest? So there's no, you know, agreement that we're going to go out and raise everything. I mean, each community is kind of dealing with it on its own. But just the mere fact that they're talking about it and acknowledging it is what puts them out front. I mean, Miami Beach is struggling right now. They're going to spend $220 million to do their redo their stormwater system.
Yeah.
But they're only going to build to the low level, to the 24 inches. Should they build for more? I mean, it's a tough thing for policymakers all over the country. How much do we spend and when?
It's a tough thing for policymakers at the federal level, at the state level, at the local level, certainly. And Jim, you're familiar mostly with the local level. Talk a little bit about the politics and how it is there intrusion into this conversation? Because, you know, among the four counties, you've got two Republicans and one Democrat. Are there significant political differences when you're there working as you are as the executive director with the South Florida Regional Planning Council?
Well, I think we're fortunate in that we don't seem to have the political polarization that exists, frankly, at the state and federal level. We do have bipartisan leaders from both parties that are in elected office. I think they're asking for the best information available. They're asking for consensus agreement among the parties that are working on this. You know, they make decisions every day. In their positions, it may not be they may not be confronted with an issue about how much are we going to spend on climate change adaptation. It might be a decision about how they're going to upgrade the sewer plant or how they're going to spend our dollars from the school bond. And I think one of the things that the compact has accomplished in the short run is that they are getting that information and the message out to everybody who in the short run are making decisions. If they are made and building in the resilience that we're talking about, we'll be in a better position as things develop in the future.
Well, Jim mentioned one thing. He mentioned that sort of to show the conflicts here. Jim mentioned the sewer plant. There's a sewer plant on Virginia Key that's been there for a long period of time. It doesn't work very well. It has leaked and spilled sewage in Biscayne Bay numerous times. And the EPA has basically come down here to force Miami-Dade County to revamp its sewage system. Miami-Dade County has resisted moving that plant. Now, all sorts of coastal sewage plants flooded during Hurricane Sandy, so it kind of makes common sense to move it. And environmental groups have sued to get them to move it, but they won't. They're promising they're going to make it resilient, but they're not saying how. And the EPA, which is also promising to take into account climate change, is not forcing the county to do it. So a lot of people are talking
the
talk.
There is a lawsuit, though, from a private group that's trying to force the county.
But there's a lot of talking the talk here, which is good. But walking the walk is still uncertain.
All right, this is the Florida Roundup, Elevation Zero, a rising seas in South Florida. Albert joins the conversation from Miami. Albert, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing? My name is Albert. I'm with the South Florida Resilience System. Great panel you got there. Really great guys. I think the last point that was just stated about walking the walk and talking the talk is the biggest issue. I see a $1.5 billion bond go through for education, a $650 million bond go through for a new bridge, and the topic of our sewer system is kind of put on the side, and we allow these bonds for beautification and advancement of different coastal communities to come through, but we truly don't, at a hyper-local level, with our commissions and our municipalities, don't address this as a priority. And I'm wondering how, from a civic level, from a citizenry level, how do we tell our local leaders that this is the most important thing?
Albert, I'm going to put that question to Alex Chadwick, who has reported on energy and environmental issues for years from a national perspective, international perspective. You can draw upon that experience in different locations, Alex, but how do you answer that inquiry from Albert?
Well, I guess the question is, so what do you do to walk the walk? And I think that the answer to that is you get involved at the community level. You make sure that this is a topic that people discuss and know about. And from my perspective, I've talked to plenty of people who say we should be doing more outreach and informing more people. I honestly think if you're going to buy a property in South Florida, it should be part of the process of acquiring the property that you look at a chart of projections for sea level rise.
Spoken
and you
like
understand
a man who doesn't own any South Florida real estate.
Yeah.
Okay,
Alex, I
grant you that. I know this would be extremely, extremely difficult and unpopular in some ways, but if you want outreach, if you want people to understand what's going to happen, and they're buying a 30-year mortgage, and you know that in 30 years, this property is going to be there will be different circumstances for this property, that ought to be part of the deal.
We know that home buyers have to, depending upon the age of the home, sign off on a lead paint disclosure, for instance. Here in South Florida, Curtis, when you do buy a home, you traditionally have to get an elevation certificate. The mortgage company, if you're going to have a mortgage, likely will require that. So there is that kind of acknowledgement. But Alex, clearly, as somebody who does not own property, and do you own property, Alex? Just let's be clear. Do you own property in South Florida?
I do not. No, but my niece owns property in Tampa, and my sister owns property in Tampa as well. So I have family who owns property there.
Alex Chadwick, and reporting for Rising Seas, a burn special, a radio documentary. We've got to move on here. Curtis Morgan with the Miami Herald, Craig Pittman with the Tampa Bay Times, and we want to thank Jim Murley, Executive Director of the South Florida Regional Planning Council, for his time. Plenty more ahead here on this roundup, on the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Still to come, what we can learn from other cities, and we will get into the debate over the long-term solutions, not just adapting. This is the Florida Roundup, Elevation Zero, Rising Seas in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson.
My name is Catherine Stewart, and I'm from Coral Gables. I am a science coach with the Miami-Dade County Public Schools. One student had learned during his investigations about how to make sand, and he learned that parrotfish make sand. And so one of his solutions was just to have farms of parrotfish around Florida, which I actually thought was was really neat for a third grader to come up with the solution. He was problem solving.
The ingenuity of youth there on display. Curtis Morgan with the Miami Herald, Alex Chadwick with Rising Seas Burn and Energy Journal radio documentary, and Craig Pittman from the Tampa Bay Times joined me here on the Florida Rondo for Elevation Zero on WLRN. Craig, I saw you nodding and smiling a little bit to that solution. Parrotfish. Parrotfish and more sand to help address the beach erosion that Craig mentioned earlier.
I think that's a brilliant idea. The problem is that I believe those parrotfish are munching on coral. Mm-hmm. And one of the impacts of climate change has been a reduction in hard corals in throughout the Caribbean and most of their areas. And I think that may not be the only reason, but I think rising sea temperatures, which are associated with climate change, are one of the reasons. So we might want to get those herds of parrotfish out early.
Perhaps. Alex Chadwick, as you put together your Rising Seas special, looking at South Florida, you looked at the New York, New Jersey area, you looked overseas in Europe. What can we learn here in South Florida from how other coastal communities are approaching this challenge?
Well, the scientists that I've spoken to and policymakers as well, I was at a conference in Fort Lauderdale in June on this. People really like the idea that New York's mayor, Michael Bloomberg, who's now on his way out of office, had really made this an issue for the city and had devised this $20 billion plan to protect New York and to try to, you know, make the infrastructure stronger and less vulnerable. So there are kind of civic things that that people can be doing. The scientists were very impressed by New York.
But what's interesting, Alex, is that came after a significant disaster. That came after, right, obviously, Hurricane Sandy. And one of the things that we've heard on WLRN this week, as we've done this week-long coverage on Rising Seas, is that the attention, the significant public policy attention, the significant consumer attention, the stakeholder attention, the financial attention will come after a significant, fast disaster.
Well, that's always the way, isn't
it?
You know, you kind of forget about the fire department until your front steps is on fire. So I guess that is the case. But the studies that I have seen say that preparation is going to save money in the long run, and that there are things that one can do. I think that the substrate in Florida is a real problem, the limestone. I don't see how you really overcome that. I think it's a more significant problem in South Florida than it is in many places. But civic engagement, pressure from people who live in this region on public officials to address this, even though it's really hard to figure out, you know, in the cost-benefit analyses that I've read for Florida to try to adapt to this, the only thing that really pays off is beach nourishment, and that's not going to pay off for forever.
A few months ago, we had a contingent from the Netherlands come visit Miami Beach to spur on a little bit of international conversation in regards to rising seas and how a country that has been dealing with that for the better part of a couple of centuries. But the comparison between the two is something that is not lost on listener Robin Rohrpaw.
I was also shocked to hear so many people discuss what Holland does to prevent the seas from flooding that small nation. Totally different situation than what we face in South Florida.
And Alex, part of that difference is the geology to which you referred to earlier.
Yeah. You know, so in the newscast right before the real program started, Tom, there was a piece from an NPR reporter in Japan about the difficulties that Japan is having with these emissions targets that it had set 20 years ago. Quite ambitious, and they were very strong about what they were going to do. And then Fukushima happens, and their nuclear industry is all offline. And now their emissions are growing. And, you know, this is really the heart of the problem.
Yeah.
This is an energy problem.
And let me put this.
Do we fix it?
Yeah, and let me put this question to each of you on the panel. Curtis Morgan, I'll begin with you. How does this debate over climate change, the debate over climate change, contribute to the response to sea level, where we began this program, the fact that seas are higher today than they were in 1920. But how does the debate over climate change affect the response?
I'm not sure I follow. I'm sorry.
Well, if sea level rise is caused by climate change,
right,
we will put aside the cause of climate change for a moment. How does that debate that we're having, the polarization of that debate, that we still continue to have and that we've seen evidence of in Washington, evidence of in Tallahassee, affect the response to sea level rise that, as we've established, is
affect,
a fact.
How does it affect it? Nothing, not much gets done. I mean, we were talking earlier, and I think Craig could probably talk to this as well. I mean, Governor Charlie Crist, when he first came into office, wanted to be the climate change governor. He convened a green meeting down here in Miami and talked about reducing carbon emissions, and because we were the most vulnerable state, and that initiative lasted, I don't know, 9 months, and then just seemed to fall off the table. He didn't get much response. I mean, Washington has not been out front and doing much. I mean, the Corps has set these standards.
The Army Corps of Engineers.
Yeah, they quietly set these standards for public works projects.
That the Corps is involved with.
The Corps is involved with, or federal money is going towards. But the EPA has been sort of slow in addressing the issue. They've got lots of, you know, white papers, but no real policy. So it's just not a political winner for whatever reason. Maybe it's the fault of the media. Maybe it's the denialists have better PR people. I really don't know.
Craig Pittman with the Tampa Bay Times. What say you over how this debate over climate change and the cause of climate change and how it contributes to the effect of the response to rising sea level?
Well, I see it having two effects. One is the one that Curtis mentioned, which is, you know, we had a governor who said he was really interested in climate change and took a lot of steps, at least in public, to make changes. One of those steps was to create a climate change action team, and they came up with a plan for dealing with sea level rise. But their plan, as I recall, the one big recommendation was we need a better monitoring of sea level rise. Nothing about adaptation, nothing about resilience, nothing along those lines at all.
We need to measure it better.
Yes, and so I think there's that, and people I've talked to who have gone to conferences to talk about sea level rise, one professor in particular, he said he went there with all kinds of maps and charts, and he was ready to talk about making a strategic retreat from the beach, and instead everybody wanted to talk about reducing their carbon footprint. So you had people who, they believe climate change is real, and they believe sea level rise is real, but they tend to focus on dealing with climate change rather than dealing directly with the symptom of that, of sea level rise.
Alex, this is a big challenge, and it's an interesting point, and we're here, Craig, and we're here, Alex, and we're here, Curtis, in that rising sea level, the forecasts are certainly far out in the future as we sit here in 2013. We're talking about the variety of predictions for 2060, the variety of predictions of higher seas by 2100, but when we talk about climate change, we're talking about multi-century predictions and impacts. And Alex, this again affects kind of the horizon that we're seeing on the part of the response and the part of the debate that we have on climate change, the effect, the causes of climate change, and how does that, in your opinion, contribute to the effect of the response to sea level rise?
You know, I actually think that there is a factor here that large energy companies have spent millions and millions of dollars to make this argument muddier and more confusing in a way that is directly to their economic benefit. So that is a factor. But beyond that, we just don't have a great human capacity for imagining life beyond about 7 years out. That's about as far as people can plan. And yeah, so 7 years, probably everything's still going to be hunky-dory in South Florida. 7 years after that, I don't know. I just don't know that we have the human capacity to think and the kind of time scales that are involved here.
I think Sandy will be a test. I mean, if they
Hurricane Sandy.
Yeah, Hurricane Sandy, because there is, you know, as you said, disasters trigger reactions. I mean, South Florida revamped its building code after Hurricane Andrew blew the roofs off houses. So what will they do there? And how will they respond? That'll be a test.
That is Curtis Morgan from the Miami Herald. Alex Chadwick has been joining us, producer and reporter for Rising Seas, a Burn Energy Journal radio documentary, and Craig Pittman with the Tampa Bay Times, all with me. I'm Tom Hudson here on the Florida Roundup. The program will be back on the air here on WLRN at 6 a.m. tomorrow. We'll also have it on the website in a matter of hours at WLRN.org. The program is produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman. Our live chat online is hosted by Rachel Morello. Our telephone producer, Chloe Herring. Our Public Insight Network analyst, Steph Farrow. Our executive producer at WLRN, Peter J. Meritz. Our technical supervisor on the Florida Roundup, Paul Leary. Thank you, Mr. Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is next. Stay tuned. Getting ready for the 30th Miami Book Fair International. Great program. And Monday morning at 9 on the Sunshine Economy, giving it away, philanthropy in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.